Hello, this is Dr. Stephen Nurse, and this is my third and final series on the war in Vietnam, titled, A Letter is a Living Voice. We will be reading letters and documented accounts written by Vietnam veterans. These letters show all the emotion of war, from fear to anger to love and fellowship. These are only the opinions of the writers of the documents and not those of the voice of Vashon or the readers. In addition, while some of the language in the documents may appear to be racially insensitive, it is the actual language of war. It is my opinion that to use the exact language to give the listener a true understanding of the veterans' ratings and their associated emotions is extremely important. In war, we demonize our enemy through our language and our pictures. We make them inanimate, therefore easier to kill.
Wait a minute, wait a minute. Wait a minute, please pick a postman. Wait a minute, wait a minute.
Hello, this is Dr. Steve Nurse and another episode of our Vietnam series. One of the things that I'd like to talk about a little bit today is we started out just talking about letters, and as I got into looking at letters, I found some accounts of experiences in Vietnam that friends of mine had written to their parents, written to friends, and yet put them into a almost kind of a third person type of writing, but yet they really tell a lot about and almost read the same type of story as a letter would be sent to the family. And also, just to let you know, we are also going to be I'm also going to be looking at different kinds of documents to read interspersed with the letters. And Susan Schreyers is also going to be doing some reading for us. What this is, and I'm not going to put a lot of names on here, but someone sent a interview for me and added this stuff. It starts out, a little background, I grew up in Petaluma, California, a small town of Northern California. It's about 40 miles north of San Francisco in Sonoma County. The movie American Graffiti was largely filmed there in Santa Rosa and was a page out of my youth. And I think a lot of us, at least my age, 74 now, certainly was sung true to a lot of a lot of the songs that were on that movie. During most of my teenage years, I had a sponsor and was into go-kart racing, which was very popular in the 60s. I raced all over California in the Nationals in the States. My father worked as a shipyard worker in World War II, so I had no real thoughts of military service. I grew up hunting and fishing and had BB guns, 22s, and shotguns from an early age, so I was no stranger to weapons. I worked many summers since that time. I was 13 on chicken farms and a hatchery since Petaluma was the egg capital of the world back then. My father died in April 1965, and I graduated from high school in June of that year. I went to Held Engineering College in San Francisco after high school. I mostly hitchhiked from Petaluma to San Francisco and back each day. Back then, it was no big deal to hitchhike. The war in Vietnam was going on, and I remember a classmate being killed that year, but somehow it just didn't resonate with me that I might be drafted. As long as I stayed in college, I had a deferment from the draft. Well, that came the summer of love. College was only blocks away from Haight-Ashbury area, and I was introduced to marijuana around the end of the year. I loved it. Soon after that, I was going to the Fillmore Auditorium, Golden Gate Park, and the Avalon Ballroom to see Janis Joplin, Jefferson Airplane, and many other groups that became popular. I even smoked with Jerry Garcia and the Grateful Dead before they were a big deal and eventually dropped out of college in 1966. Unfortunately, at that time, marijuana was seen as being almost as serious as murder, and I got busted. I still feel guilty to this day for what I was put my mother through, but it may have actually saved my life. I was on probation for 3 years, and that alone kept me from being drafted. My mother died unexpectedly in 1969, so I had to move from my hometown. Eventually, I got a job in Oakland and went to visit my aunt in Petaluma for Thanksgiving that year. Apparently, my mail had been forwarded to her, and she gave me an envelope that announced I had been drafted and had a report on December 3rd. I had 5 days to prepare for something I wasn't prepared for. I was flown to Fort Lewis, Washington for basic, first time on an airplane. And I think that's kind of interesting. Do you remember, Susan, the first time you were on an airplane?
I was 18 years old. I remember it very well.
Yeah. How about you, Rick?
Yeah, I was on a turboprop from Syracuse to
Rochester.
On
top of it? Or, quite a ride.
Yeah, I remember what it was like, though. It was an interesting ride.
I had mine the first time when my mother and I took a four-prop compressed air kind of environment. And we went back to my grandfather was getting put into a nursing home. And it was at that time when polio was really still pretty rampant. And I remember getting on the plane and I was about fourth grade and we, everybody wore masks and we came back on a train and that was the same thing, but it was pretty scary time for a kid. But I certainly remember that. Okay, I was flown to Fort Lewis for the first time on an airplane, then sent to Fort Sam Houston in San Antonio, Texas, for 10 weeks training to become a medic. The entire time I was nervous and overwhelmed and felt like a stranger in a strange land. And how many times have we heard that? Felt like a stranger in a strange land. They knock you down and then eventually build you back up with confidence. But I never thought I'd actually be in combat. I was surprised when I learned I was going to Vietnam along with just about everyone else in my class. And I know in my class, almost half the males in my graduating class of 1966 wound up in Vietnam either that year or the next couple years. I arrived in Vietnam via a commercial airline. Unlike the Marines that were shipped by boat, we flew like we were going on a holiday somewhere. I remember being hit by extreme heat and humidity when I got to the steps of the plane. I almost tripped on the way down because it was so overwhelming. Shortly thereafter, I was told I would be put in a part of the Army's 1st Cavalry Division that was given a few days of, in quotes, intense jungle training. Before being flown on a C-130 to LZ Buttons, which is LZ stands for landing zone, near Song Bay in the Third Corps region of Vietnam. At first, I thought I'd be working in Saigon. Then I figured I would be in an aid station at Song Bay. Big surprise. I had a big duffel bag, and guys were going through it saying, you won't need this, you won't need this, while filling a backpack. Finally, they had it filled and said, see, that chopper, get on it, and it's headed for Cambodia. That pack weighed about 80 pounds, so I needed help with it. And shortly thereafter, I was on the ground meeting up with a company of grunts. There were typically 4 platoons to a company, so I was a medic for a platoon of about 26 guys, excuse me. It was all pretty much downhill from there. I quickly found out we would be in the field hunting and being hunted for 3 weeks at a time. No shower, no shave, and only the provisions we carried on our backs. If conditions were good, we would get supplied once a week with sea rations, water, mail, and whatever we needed to stay out. I encountered lots of poisonous snakes, spiders, leeches, mosquitoes, and other things in the jungle. Every time we stopped, I was treating guys for jungle rot, ringworm, you name it, keep them going. Nixon had been authorized a 2-month incursion into Cambodia by American troops beginning in May and ending on June 30th, 1970. It was estimated there were around 70,000 enemy troops who were being sent through what they called the Fishhook region throughout the south of Vietnam. We destroyed many bunkers and captured tons of rice, ammo, vehicles, etc. during those 2 months. Fighting wasn't as bad as they expected. Since they knew we were coming, they were frequently chose not to do battle with us. It really set off a firestorm of protests at home, though, with the most noteworthy being the Kent State shooting by the Ohio National Guard. And I don't think, at least people our age, if you say that, the Kent State shooting, how many of you can think of that, the girl, the young woman who's over the boy, that young man that's shot, and she's crying and kind of has, I mean, there are some pictures like that that just, to me, resonate to me, or like the Buddhist who set himself on fire during the Vietnam War, or the colonel that shoots the Viet Cong in the head during that time. That just will always be kind of carved in our memories. An incident with C-4 explosives got me out of the bush and eventually reassigned to Nu Ba Ra, a mountain overlooking Song Bay, which was used as a radio relay and G-2 intelligence gathering location for the first CAV. I was the lone medic up there until March 1971, when we turned it over to the South Vietnamese. It was very primitive, but at least I had a cot to sleep on and hot meals. The sister mountain, Nu Ba Den, was overrun in 1968, and just about all the soldiers up there were massacred, so I considered myself lucky. We only had occasional snipers shooting at us. The biggest issue were rats the size of domestic cats, scorpions, and cobra snakes, to name a few. I still have nightmares of rats jumping on me at night. And again, you know, many of the men that I talked about, you know, all the not so fun animals that you found in Vietnam. And also they said somewhat jokingly, when you got up in the morning and you put your civvies on, your underwear on, you check for scorpions very closely. And of course, almost all the hospitals there, all the areas had anti-venom, you know, kits for those things. But I've never been stung by a scorpion, but I understand it's not something you want to experience. After leaving the mountain, I was given the chance to spend my last month up at the DMZ, Demilitarized Zone, or served what remained of my two-year commitment, stateside. I chose stateside and was eventually sent back to Fort Lewis. I got out early in September 1971 as a Specialist 4. Incidents that I remember the most include July 4th, 1970, walking along the river most of the day. Leeches were crawling up us from the ground and dropping out of the trees on us for hours. There must have been millions of them. Several occasions where we would be pulled from one area and reinserted into another area where they thought we would find more enemy soldiers. We got on choppers, fresh troops got off, and within minutes of us leaving, they got us shot up badly. A day where three medics from a company were killed. We replaced them and took heavy small arms fire going in. Guys in front of me killed several men and women soldiers. A day when we were pulled to look for and protect the missing Huey belonging to General George Casey. It was found with no survivors. He was on the way to meet with wounded soldiers at a hospital. A day when one of our guys stopped breathing, and I had to do CPR on him. As far as I know, he survived. There were others, but I mostly remember these. I also remember the day when we were being shot at early on, and I made the decision that if I survived, I would go back to college and try to make something of myself. My older sister was my only consistent contact. So when I landed at Travis Air Force Base, I got on a bus to her house. People from several rows around got up and moved and started calling me a baby killer. An older gentleman came over and told me he was a veteran of World War II, and he would sit with me. I was just happy to be alive, but it was pretty rude. Glad things are different now. Once I got out of the service, I enrolled at community college with the help of the GI Bill and working weekends and summers as a park ranger for the city of Fremont. I got AA degree and served to San Francisco State, where I worked part-time as physical therapy aide and got my BA from there. I did a semester of graduate work and then moved to the Pacific Northwest, where I found a job in the office products industry, which is where I stayed for 40 years. We lived in Seattle area, including Vashon. Although the way I got married will be, along the way I got married, says will be 50 years next March, had two boys that turned out to be very successful businessmen, and four wonderful grandchildren. The military experience actually really helped me get a focus, and I found that with determination and a strong work ethic, I could accomplish just about anything I put my mind to. I look back on my 2 years in the Army as one of the most significant experiences of my life and something I'm proud of now. for years, I never talked about it, but I'm glad I had the experience. As far as the war in Vietnam is concerned, I have mixed feelings about it. I hate to think over 58,000 Americans died for no good reason, but I kind of feel that way. The Vietnamese have moved forward, and the threat of a communist domino action in Southeast Asia never happened. I see furniture labeled Made in Vietnam in department stores, and I have heard the people there are mostly young and not bitter towards Americans in general. My thinking is, if we are going to send troops into harm's way, let them fight and don't interfere politically. Even in the Middle East, I understand there are several levels of approval required just to engage the enemy. That's not right. Interesting. I think that lots of good advice there. And it also, Susan, tell me what you think about this. It's the stories that we've been reading really shows to me kind of average Joe or average person this was out there that went to Vietnam. These weren't, you know, hardened killers out there or mercenaries. What do you think of it? Don't they sound kind of eclectic?
Absolutely. I think that the draft didn't have any favoritism.
Yeah.
You know, it was just luck of the draw. They pulled names out of a hat. I mean, I don't know exactly how they came up with who got drafted and who didn't. I was surprised that his arrest and his probation and his record didn't protect him from the draft.
But. Right. Right. And it kind of shows you how much they needed people. I was in when they had the draft and when they had the big pull, it was, I'm trying to think, it was probably 1968 about then. And I was going to Central Washington University. At that time, you smoked every place. So we all went over to the Student Union building, which was a purple haze of smoke and coffee in the Student Union building. And all the space, there were, I would say it was mostly males because everybody watched it on television. It was mostly males and few women, and certainly there were some wives, you know, college wives that were there. And we watched as they pulled, it was like bingo. They had ping pong balls. And in a big thing, and there were one for every day of the year, and I can't remember what they did for leap year. I don't know if you were a leap year baby, but I'm sure that somehow got you pulled in there. But it was kind of said that if you were in the first 100, you were pretty much sure going. And those were the men that I knew that would said, you know, that would try to get in, would try to, at that point, enlist into Coast Guard or, you know, something that was, you know, less dangerous. And then then there was kind of a middle ground. And then if you were going to be like 240 on up, your chances of getting called were not very good. But I think mine was almost 300. And I think they sold a lot of beer in Ellensburg that night from people either being very happy or very sad.
Or scared.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I pulled a 137, I think.
Uh-huh.
Which puts you in the gray zone.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, how big a risk do you want to take? And I decided I didn't want to take much of a risk, so.
people our age would call that the Twilight Zone, yeah. You know. Do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do.
Yeah, you might get called or you might not. I don't know. Of course, it doesn't matter how it turned out. The effect was, how was it at that time? You know, do you think you're going to be lucky or not? And
are you lucky? Do you feel lucky,
yeah,
punk?
Exactly.
But it was interesting, too, because I think it was almost like a fun kind of atmosphere to listen to that, not having any realization of the reality.
Back to what I said earlier, 18-year-olds are, you know, they think they're invincible. They don't think bad things are going to happen to them.
Oh, I remember sitting around it. It wasn't any party atmosphere where I was watching.
Oh, is that
right? It was the same kind of thing. It was in the dorms break room, or, you know, the day room. And everybody was just sweating it.
Yeah.
And, you know, the first few, you know, were like, I don't know, did they start at the back or did they start at the front?
I think.
I don't remember.
Yeah.
But.
I'm not sure, but I think Susan makes a really good point. I mean, you know, to some people, they were really scared. You know, we've interviewed people that were really, really scared that did not want to go. And yet others, like Robert, that was 17 and wanted to go to war and wanted to kill people. I mean, that was, you know, that was kind of the way it was. It was, and to save America. And it just turned out so, so different. I think, you know, people would say that when they were in Vietnam, that I'm sure there were many that were not afraid, but there certainly were a lot that were. And I think that, all of us have been in situations that have been very scary but not necessarily be, in that kind of, death-defying atmosphere.
Yeah.
I would say, Susan, you were a woman in 1968.
Yeah, I've been a woman for a lot of years.
Yes. But did in at that time, of course, you know, women kind of assumed they were not. I mean, they weren't going to be drafted.
Right.
But do you remember any feelings about it or?
Well,
I
had two brothers, and uh-huh. in 1968, I had a boyfriend who ended up in Vietnam, you know, it was a scary time for everybody. I think we were used to, you know, the 50s were kind of an idyllic time, and the early 60s, and then all of a sudden there was this war in this place that you know, I can remember the first time I said, where exactly is Vietnam? Can I see it on a map?
Yeah.
I had no idea where it was.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, interesting. It was kind of, you know, we'd just gotten through Eisenhower as president, you know, who was a general. And I think everybody was feeling pretty patriotic. And we watched Dick Van Dyke on TV and... Leave It to Beaver, who is now, I don't know, Beaver has not left yet, I mean, it was very, very idyllic and very traditional families. I mean, in my neighborhood, I don't know what about you, but in my neighborhood, there was one mother that worked out of the house, and you know, other than just kind of being a housewife, and that was unusual, you know. Certainly has changed now. Well, thank you for listening to this episode and our discussion, and we appreciate it. And Vashon, we will hear you again, or you will hear us again, or maybe we'll hear from you. I don't know. But... anyhow, we'll be back next week. Thank you. Please, Mr. Foe.
listening to Is Abled with Dr. Stephen Nurse. This has been part three of his series on the war in Vietnam entitled A Letter is a Living Voice. To hear additional episodes, including his previous series on the Vietnam War, go to voiceofvashon.org and look for Is Abled under the Shows tab.